From WXXI News, this is Healthy Friday. I'm Helen B. and Duty Hofer. In the past few weeks, you have likely heard something in the news about MERS. Now, MERS stands for Middle East Respiratory Syndrome. Why have you been hearing about it? Well, earlier this month, on May 2nd, the first U.S. case of MERS was confirmed in a traveler who came to the U.S. from Saudi Arabia. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, that person has fully recovered and has been released from the hospital. However, later this month, a second U.S. case of MERS was confirmed. Now, the World Health Organization says at this time, the illness doesn't constitute a global health emergency, but there have been nearly 600 cases of it, including 171 deaths, and the number of countries with confirmed cases has spread to 18. So today we're going to learn more about MERS, the symptoms, and the likelihood of a case or cases being reported in our community. To help navigate the issue, I'm joined on the phone by Dr. Mark Shelley. Dr. Shelley is an associate professor in the Department of Medicine at Highland Hospital, and he's also an infectious disease expert. Dr. Shelley, thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me on.
Wonderful. Just to begin, the news coverage of MERS as of late has made it a little tough to understand whether MERS is in fact a real threat here in the U.S. or possibly in New York State or the Rochester area. And I wanted to get your take on that. Is it potentially a threat?
Well, the issue with the threat is it a threat today? No. Is it a threat over the horizon? It could be. And that's, I think, the sort of differentiating point. I don't expect that we certainly don't know of any cases circulating in Rochester. So am I concerned that it's here already? No. But if it were to arrive and were to become more transmissible person to person, it would be a big deal. It depends. It depends where it is as far as getting here and how well it's spreading in our environment. We've just had the two cases in the U.S. There was the wake-up call, but I've been watching, the accounts of what's happening in the Middle East with great interest, because it is always it's the next virus that comes where we don't have immunity and where we're going to have to react to it.
And in regards to the two cases that were confirmed in the U.S., both patients were healthcare providers, and they were working in Saudi Arabia. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say the fact they're healthcare workers. Mm-hmm. I think that of the cases that have happened, about 300 plus have happened sort of in the last 2 months in the Middle East. About two thirds of them have been healthcare workers, and what that says is, well, the healthcare workers had one special thing involved, and that was they probably got it from somebody who had it. Okay. That means person-to-person transmission.
Okay.
So the first thing that we look for with a new virus would be, well, do people are the number of cases increasing, or was this just one weird case?
Mm-hmm.
Once you see the number of cases, then you say, okay, for it to be an epidemic problem, it has to pass from person to person. And if it's healthcare workers that are getting infected, then you wonder, well, I guess it's being passed from person to person, so in some ways, healthcare workers are a early warning system, and that's in fact what happened with the SARS virus, a similar virus that happened in, I think it was 2008. I'm forgetting when SARS happened,
right.
But that was the case where they suddenly realized, wait a minute, we have a lot of healthcare workers who are out ill. Something must be going on.
So, in order for, I guess, in terms of how a virus like this could make its way here to the U.S., it comes down to person-to-person contact.
Right. And anybody could bring a virus on a plane flight. Usually the incubation with things like this is in terms of days to a few weeks. Well, anybody could bring the virus over on a plane flight once they're exposed. The question is, are people likely to be exposed and, not even know it? And that often has to do with how efficient it is in spreading from person to person. And that's where you sort of get this mixed message from WHO and CDC. Mm-hmm. On one hand, I want everybody to be watching for it in the hospital when somebody comes in with a severe respiratory infection. I want everybody to ask, hey, any chance you were just in Saudi Arabia? On the other hand, it hasn't shown itself to be exquisitely transmissible. Then you'd see it not just in the guy who brought the guy in on the ambulance or who took care of them in the hospital. Then you'd see it in the person who was, you know, went to the grocery store with him. And so that threshold of how easily it's transmitted is the key dynamic that makes it from this thing is going to take off like wildfire,
right,
or this thing is going to just is still sputtering along and we can just keep a close eye on it.
And Dr. Shelley, I'm sure we have some listeners tune in right now, and they're saying, what exactly is MERS? You know, what's the source of this virus, and how does it relate to SARS? You mentioned that. If you can, just break that down a little bit.
Well, there's a lot of different kinds of viruses. They're, you know, each characterized in ways that I'm sure they probably don't really want to know all the characterization. But there's a family of viruses that are called coronaviruses. And coronaviruses cause disease in a number of different animals, including humans. And their usual disease, the coronavirus is, you know, kind of ho-hum, it causes a cold. So not much to be said about a coronavirus. On the other hand, there have been some of these coronaviruses that have caused severe illness. Maybe the common coronavirus in somebody whose immunity is non-existent or very low may cause severe illness. And in the case of the severe adult respiratory syndrome, that version of the virus that happened had a couple of things about it. One is it was efficient in transmitting from person to person and was very severe. So that SARS was a big deal. And at that point, that specific strain, which even though technically it's in the coronavirus family and it isn't like a slight mutation, these mutations are you know, things that happen at one point and then they start, you know, spreading around rather than thinking, well, I have the common cold virus, somebody else is going to get,
right,
you know, SARS from it because it's going to mutate in me. No, these are things that are specific mutations. We have the tools now to identify specific information about viruses much faster than we could before, so they can test it and say, wait a minute, this coronavirus is different from the other ones we've been seeing, and start going from there.
You touched upon this briefly, and I want to get back to it again. From what I understand, the first cases of MERS were diagnosed in 2012 in Saudi Arabia,
yep,
and Jordan.
Mm-hmm.
And then, and now it's just over the past several months, it seems like, or actually the past few years, it just seems like the momentum is, you know, growing. We're hearing more and more and more about it. Why do you think so much more now?
Well, I think the first thing is when a virus, you know, let's say a critical mutation happens, And some people get ill with it. It may take us a while to see that patient who was very sick with something we didn't have an answer for what they were sick with, it may take us a while to figure out that that's what they had. So there's the detection.
Okay.
It may take a while when it's at the one case every year type of range. It may take us a while. Eventually, when we're more aware of that, is, did you hear the guy in the next city is having trouble in Saudi Arabia?
Mm-hmm,
then,
mm-hmm.
Then we get a test, and the test is efficient at detecting it. So once we have an effective test at detecting it, we start detecting more cases and understanding more about the disease. So there is some increased detection that happens over time. But the other thing that happens over time is if you have a virus, let's say that you have one infected person. If they infect somebody else, now you have, you know, let's say you have the first person and the second person.
Right.
If they keep passing it around, it may start becoming more efficient at living and multiplying inside people. These are tiny mutations in it that result in more cases. But what we do know that so far, I think it's like you said at the beginning, about 600 total cases.
Mm-hmm.
Of those 600, about 300 of the known cases have happened recently. So there is the concern that whether it's continued transmission person to person, or whether there's some reservoir where it's, you know, let's say that it's in the camels or something like that,
mm-hmm.
that more and more camels are getting it or some way the reservoir or the person-to-person efficient transmission efficiency is increasing, resulting in more cases.
All right, you're tuning in to Healthy Friday. We are talking about MERS, something we've been hearing a lot about in the news as of late. And my guest today, Dr. Mark Shelley from Highland Hospital. And I want to talk a little bit about symptoms, Dr. Shelley. And you touched upon this. You said it affects the lower and upper respiratory tracts. It leads to coughing, shortness of breath. It can lead to fever and pneumonia. How are doctors able to determine whether the people who are reported to have it actually do, in fact, have MERS? How are they tested?
Well, nowadays there's so many things done by PCR testing. That would be a very accurate and very specific DNA or RNA test that can tell you this genetic pattern is present. So we have a test, for example, that we use fairly routinely that tells us whether or not a patient has a coronavirus. Now, the test that we use, it's so specific, it tells us four different kinds of coronavirus, but it won't pick up SARS or MERS because we, you know, haven't had it here yet, and you know, that's not a commercially produced test. But there are people who have the specific type of testing that would tell us, no, yes, this is a coronavirus of a specific type that we're looking for. And currently, we'd run that test only if there was the appropriate history. And so the CDC has said, well, if somebody came from the Middle East within the last 2 weeks, or if they were directly caring for somebody who had or had direct exposure to somebody who had MERS, then we would bother with that test. The problem comes out is where, you know, somebody said, well, you know, 2 years ago I went for a, you know, vacation in Saudi Arabia. Should I be worried about that? And the answer is no. If it was 1 month ago, you don't have to be worried about it. It's a two-week incubation. And under those rules, then if somebody came into my hospital with a severe respiratory infection that didn't have a clear other explanation and they had a recent travel history to Saudi Arabia, we would do very careful isolation in the hospital to avoid spread to healthcare workers and others. And we would call the health department and say, I've got somebody I want you to run specimens on for me to detect this specific infection.
We're talking to Dr. Shelley of Highland Hospital about MERS. If you are listening right now, you've got a question about this, two numbers you can call, 844-295-8255. The other number you're familiar with, 263-9994. And Dr. Shelley, is it possible that some people infected with MERS, they don't have any of the symptoms that you mentioned?
Yeah, I think that what we usually find out once we start looking at things more closely is that some people get a more mild illness. Obviously, you wouldn't pick that up as a new infection if you had a mild illness, they had a cold, and it lasted 2 weeks, and it went away. You wouldn't bother doing any fancy tests to figure out why they had a cold that went away. And so there are probably some individuals who are having mild illness. That said, they have often tested people who have been exposed looking for that mild illness, and they haven't found it, you know, showing up in large numbers of people or large number of people who haven't had more serious symptoms. We just know that there are some individuals who are having a much milder expression of illness. So this would be an example of if somebody came, my wife had just come back from Saudi Arabia 1 week ago, and she had a bit of a cold. And now it's, you know, another week later, and I'm coming down with a severe respiratory tract infection. Well, then I should... it would be possible that that's the transmission pattern that had happened. But it wouldn't be expected that that somebody with mild symptoms would be a super spreader and spread it to everybody around them. It's likely they would spread less, and that in most cases, even in the community, there hasn't been spread even to a single secondary case, much less, you know, turning into an epidemic. But that's the kind of thing that things, places like the CDC and the WHO and departments of health are charged with. Let's be sure that there's nothing new happening. And if there is something new happening, get out the best advice we can.
Well, let me ask you this. In the airports, we're seeing warning signs. We're seeing signs about MERS. What kinds of precautions should people take? Because when things like this happen, there's this fear. You know, we're approaching a very popular travel season right now. If folks are traveling, should they put off a trip?
Well, I certainly wouldn't say to put off a trip because we're talking about something that's, that still is in a very small number and very specific situation. I think that we can probably learn most from what we know about the other coronaviruses, and that would be, all right, people shouldn't be in a situation where people are coughing in your face, which is what we all would want to avoid, and that, a clearly symptomatic traveler, that would not be a good thing. That doesn't mean that every cough is a problem, but, somebody who is newly ill, that person probably shouldn't be traveling just because we should travel when we're healthy and better able to handle it. As far as what do you do? Well, most of the time, these things are spread within 1 yard or 1 meter.
Wow.
So people who are that close to you and coughing in your face, well, that's where there'd be an opportunity for it. They're sometimes spread by touching things and then touching your eyes or your nose from that standpoint. So those are the two main ways that other coronaviruses have been spread. We don't know whether this one's going to have, some new twist to that. But that's the primary issue, so that if you keep your distance from people to some degree so that they're not coughing into your face, you wash your hands, and particularly cleanse your hands before you touch your nose and eyes, perhaps your mouth, but less so your mouth. That is part of a general protection, not just to avoid MERS, but to avoid colds and other problems. Alcohol-based hand rubs are effective at killing this type of virus.
Okay.
So if you plan to travel, having a little bit of alcohol gel, of course, putting it in your 3-1-1 quart bag going through security, is not a bad idea, so that you can be more sure that you're not introducing new viruses onto susceptible surfaces of the body.
And Dr. Shelley, let's talk just a little bit about treatment. And in regards to treatment with MERS, what kinds of treatments are out there and available?
Well, right now there's nothing. Viruses are very simple organisms, and we have no specific treatment that we could use for a virus from that standpoint, or an antiviral, like we would give an antibiotic. The treatment would be supportive. Give them oxygen, support them while their body fights the infection.
Mm-hmm.
And with time, we'll come up with whether there's anything else to be done. Sometimes there's antibody treatments or others. But at present, there is nothing other than supportive care and avoiding spread from person to person that we can do in a situation like this. That said, supportive care is not insignificant. If you have a severe viral pneumonia that you're going to get over in 2 weeks, but you can't survive that without being on a ventilator to give you oxygen, well, being on a ventilator to give you oxygen is a very significant treatment in those situations.
As you mentioned, this is isolated to a particular area. Is there a particular age group, let's say, that would travel to Saudi Arabia for any number of reasons, whether for healthcare, vacation, whatever it might be? Is there a particular age that should be really paying attention to some of the symptoms that we've discussed, and a group that you would say, if these come up, I really want you to act?
I've seen a couple of places where there's a suggestion, or maybe people who are otherwise immunocompromised, et cetera. I look at it, and I see them reporting cases in children, elderly, and middle-aged. So given that we're in the first 600 cases, and it's not likely to become a global epidemic before it's changed a little bit more, I think it would be premature to say, well, this is going to hit kids harder or older adults harder or middle-aged adults harder. We really don't know the answer to that. If we're looking forward, but I would say that it's the kind of thing that we have to watch at all ages and with all groups, but knowing that people who are otherwise have poor respiratory function, it takes less of an illness to get them into trouble.
when we started our conversation, you mentioned, Dr. Shelley, that this is not a threat today, possibly a threat on the horizon. And I want to read, here are some recent headlines that I came across in regards to MERS. Health officials race to contain dangerous MERS outbreak. Another one, MERS outbreak becomes more urgent. And this would seem to indicate that there's a potential threat. But as you mentioned, this is not something that's big today, but something that we need to pay attention to possibly for the near future. With headlines like these, what... I guess, what would you tell people who read them? You know, listeners right now who see these things in the news, they get online and check out any news source and they see this and they do get scared and they do get worried. Are there misconceptions that, that you would want to address in regards to this?
Well, I think I actually try to observe this on a number of different things that people are reporting. You know, this week it's one thing and next week it's another.
Right, right.
First thing, we have great tools to identify viruses now. With genetics, the PCR testing type of stuff. So we get to know about outbreaks and why they're happening faster. That's a good thing. That's the detection. That's like the tripwire that lets us know, pay attention, this is out there. The next step in whatever the next epidemic is, the next step is it transmitted from person to person?
Right.
So they watch closely to see whether or not, hey, there was five people in that family. The dad got ill. Did the kids get ill? Did the wife get ill? And so far, what we're finding out is there have been some family clusters, and there have actually been since even very early in this, there were clusters of families, including families that had traveled. Then they start getting at stuff that's a little harder to explain, but they start talking about, well, if you have one person who's infected, how many other people are likely to be infected from that person? Sometimes people will call this the R0, you know, how many more people are going to be infected? And what they're watching is if one person's infected, enters into a community, and then two people are infected, well, then for each of those two people, two more people, and then you got four, and then you got eight, that's what an epidemic looks like. It keeps doubling. And if the number is less than one, so one person enters into a community, and on odds, you know, only every other time somebody would be infected, that would be a R0 of 0.5, less likely to transmit in a community, not so much a worry that it's going to go off like wildfire. And by watching how efficiently it's traveling between people, that's the key. What's a concern in an epidemic is that some mutation would happen that suddenly would make it much more efficient in passing from person to person. And that's why it's gotten the headlines and why it's gotten sort of a little moved up on the scale as far as what WHO and others have been saying about it is because it looks like it's getting better, but it's still far short of the one that makes two cases make four cases, and so on, that we would really worry about. So it's good that we're watching, and that's a common thing. But if you watch for that, the first question you ask when somebody says there's a new virus out there is, has it been transmitted from person to person yet? Because, you know, if they say you can only catch it from a camel, I know how not to get it.
Right, right. All right, well, first of all, I want to thank you so much. Dr. Mark Shelley, Associate Professor in the Department of Medicine at Highland Hospital, also an infectious disease expert. Thank you for taking the time to break down MERS, something we've heard about, something we need to know about. So thank you so much for your expertise.
You're so welcome. Thank you.
Coming up in our second hour, it's Healthy Friday continuing with Elisa Orlando. She'll take your calls on issues that she's discussing with medical professionals. It's your chance to hear not only the latest research and the latest news on certain issues, but your chance to talk to people from the medical field and get their feedback on your questions or concerns. It's Healthy Friday, Hour 2 with Elisa Orlando coming up.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Bond, Schenick & King, a full-service law firm with 225 attorneys serving corporate, institutional, and individual clients in Rochester, New York State, and nationally. Bond, Schenick & King, commitment, service, and value, our bond. BSK.com.
Hi, I'm Helen Biandudi-Hofer, and up next on Healthy Friday, we're looking into two studies questioning some commonly held beliefs that might not have been well understood, and it's all related to heart health. So to dig into the studies and to help explain what we need to know, I'm joined on the phone by Dr. Tim Malins and Dr. Chad Teeters. Dr. Malins is a Rochester General Health System cardiologist, and Dr. Teeters is a cardiologist at Highland Hospital. And I understand, Dr. Malins, you're joining me right now. We will wait for Dr. Teeters, but thank you so much for being on Healthy Friday today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So to begin, for our wine lovers listening right now who take great pride in enjoying that glass of Merlot or Pinot Noir or Malbec because it's good for your heart, right? Well, you may want to sit down for this conversation because a recent study shows that red wine might not be as good for your heart as researchers first thought, at least in the doses we get as Americans. So here's the deal. There's an antioxidant in red wine. It's called resveratrol. It's a mouthful. It's also in dark chocolate, certain fruits and vegetables, and it's supposed to be healthy for your heart. So with this study, I'm going to give you just a little bit of background for our listeners. Researchers from Johns Hopkins University, they collected data on nearly 800 Italians. All of them were at least 65 years old, starting in 1998. So over 9 years, researchers measured the levels of resveratrol in their urine. And at the end, they found there were no differences in rates of death and cancer and heart disease among those with the highest levels of this antioxidant compared to those with the lowest levels. So what does this all mean? And Dr. Malins, should we be buying into the hype and the headlines right now that say there are no health benefits from red wine?
Well, I think the interesting part of this study is, so I think you really got to go back to what we call the red wine paradox, the French paradox,
which is
what we see. The French have a relatively high amount of saturated fat in their diet, but a relatively low amount of heart disease. And so being a cardiologist doesn't make a lot of sense. And so some epidemiologists, those who study populations, presume that maybe, since they also have a relatively high amount of red wine in their diet, that it was the red wine which is protecting them against heart disease. Now, let's fast forward a little bit to 2006, where some researchers at Harvard had looked at the antioxidant resveratrol, and it is a mouthful, as you pointed out.
Thanks. I guess I said it wrong.
No, that's just fine. And so their thought, and this is one of the many antioxidants in red wine, is that this could be doing it. And so this study that was published in the journal Nature in 2006 showed that they compared two groups of overweight mice. They looked at those that weren't given resveratrol and those that were given very high doses of this. So we're talking 100 to 1,000 times more than the amount that you can get from a couple of glasses of wine a day. And what this showed is that when they compared the overweight mice that weren't given this to those that were, is that the overweight mice that did get this supplement had lower death rates, and they actually lived longer. And so we'll fast forward now. The supplement industry and everybody gets a hold of this and says, okay, well, hey, this is our answer. It's this resveratrol, which is a polyphenol and antioxidant, and that's what is saving people's lives. And so, as you pointed out, Johns Hopkins researchers had 783 Italian men and women greater than or 65 or greater, and they followed them for 9 years, and they looked at things like cancer outcomes, lifespan, heart disease, and inflammation. And at relatively low levels of resveratrol that they're getting, there was no evidence that, at least at these levels, that it changed cancer rates, changed heart rates, made people live longer, or decreased inflammation.
Okay, so I just want to make sure I've got this right. You know, for our listeners too, and Dr. Teeters, I hear you're on the line, so please join in. This most recent study then from Johns Hopkins, it's not really saying red wine is bad. It's just not saying it's not good. Is that right, or is it that we can't drink enough to make it good for us?
Well, I think this answers the resveratrol, or at least gives us more studies to look at, but it answers at low levels. It doesn't look like it's doing it. Now, supplementation there, from my knowledge, there's been no study that's compared high dose to people not taking it. But I do want to point out one thing. Red wine in moderation, and this is really true of all alcohol, does give you some health benefits. It'll increase your good cholesterol. And there's some observational studies that just moderate alcohol intake is possibly associated with longevity. So don't throw out your red wine. If you're a moderate drinker, you can continue drinking it. I stop short of telling people who don't drink to start taking up drinking. I don't go that far. But if you're a moderate drinker, be it red wine, be it whiskey, be it beer, I don't think it's going to cause you much problems.
So there are people right now that are relieved and clapping their hands, I'm sure, as they hear that from you. You mentioned that people take resveratrol in supplements. So question for both of you. What if we get it that way? I mean, what type of impact could it have in an effort to prevent any number of diseases?
Yeah, Chad, you can go ahead.
So I think one of the things about all of these supplements that we found, especially dietary supplements, is that it's much more complicated than just one compound. And oftentimes, even with resveratrol, there's something more to it than just the resveratrol itself, and it probably may be several components that act together to give you the benefits that we seem to see with red wine. And the same thing that we talk about with other antioxidants that we see, we've had very few studies that say if you just give high levels of these isolated antioxidants, that it actually does much, that we see much health benefit. And so I think, if you know, number one, this study points out in part that if you just look at a few hundred people, you're unlikely to see something that may take thousands of people to really demonstrate. And probably, you know, maybe it's not just the type of wine that this group of people drinks, or, you know, maybe there's something to the fact that you have to drink it from the time that you're 30 and not just from the time that you're 65. There's all these other confounding factors that are very hard to take into account when you start talking about these lifestyle and dietary things that we come into contact with. And when you try to purify out any one piece, you're only probably getting one very small piece of the puzzle.
Got it.
And so as we go on, we'll learn more, and we might be able to find that resveratrol plus something else is the magic bullet. But seldom do I think we're ever going to find that any one dietary supplement can be the key.
When both of you looked at the study, did you believe that there were any factors that were omitted from the study that could have presented a fuller or clearer picture?
You know, I think personally, from my standpoint, I think it's an admirable study, and I think it's interesting to go to a region where there's a high consumption and to look at it. And, you know, they followed these patients forward for 9 years, but there's so many things that we don't have. What's their activity level? What are these people dying of? Are they dying of cancer at 66, and they don't have time to really have or develop heart disease? How did they define, you know, heart disease in the population? Maybe they didn't die in 9 years, but maybe they all had 5 heart attacks or didn't have heart attacks. There's all these other keys that would cost a lot of money to find all these things out to make it a very valid study. And oftentimes, you know, the money is not there to do those kind of comprehensive, large population-based studies. But to really apply it to any one patient, you'd really need to know that kind of information to see how it extrapolates, and does it apply to patients in Rochester, New York, for example.
Got it. And so any other misconceptions in with this? I looked at the headlines, and I saw a lot when looking up this and reading this, and, you know, people were saying, you know, that this study kind of was a bust for people who enjoyed drinking red wine, and they also enjoy drinking it because they feel like it's doing their heart some good. Were there any other misconceptions that you believe should be addressed with this?
I think looking at the headlines, and I mean, I think they make for good headlines, but I'm not sure that this changes practice as far as what Chad and I would do. I mean, this looked at one compound at relatively low levels. I think this probably answers the question that is it just the resveratrol in red wine which gives you possibly some associated longevity. Now, I think this was pretty good at showing that, but I also am not going to tell those who have moderate red wine consumption that they need to stop. So I don't think it changes our practice. It gives us some more data as to what the potential is of giving some longevity or protecting in cardiovascular disease. But I'm a red wine drinker. I believe Chad is too. And it's not going to change that for me. Because I think, again, as I said before, moderate red wine consumption or moderate alcohol consumption is quite reasonable. And as long as you're not going to extremes, because as you get into the heavier alcohol use, then any benefit that you can get from it is offset by liver disease, pancreatitis, increased cancer risk, and all of those things. So it's you've got to stop at one or two glasses. But that, from my standpoint at least, is just fine and may be giving you some benefit.
Okay.
And I think one other thing to piggyback on the back of that is that one of the knocks against this study in particular has been that the way that they calculated resveratrol exposure was urinary excretion. But one of the key things about resveratrol, and one of the hesitations that many people have to say, is this really the magic bullet, even within red wine, mm-hmm. is that it's metabolized so quickly. Hmm. That one of the questions is this really even available in the bloodstream long enough to have any significant effect? And perhaps in this study, by just checking urinary excretion episodically, you're not really getting a full picture of how much consumption there was 2 weeks ago versus how much there was last night.
Got it. Well, let's transition just a little bit, and we're going to look at a study that presents a similar situation. Heart health is about diet and exercise, right? So onto the exercise part of the equation. There are two new studies, and they're questioning the value of strenuous exercise, like running, for heart health. And they're saying that too much high-intensity exercise might even be not as good for you as we may have thought. Now, I love my high-intensity workouts. I go to a CrossFit boot camp during the week, and I was surprised to hear this. So I'm curious if I'd like for both of you actually to, you know, break down what this really means.
Tim, why don't you take the first shot, or I can go first, whichever way you prefer.
No, I'll talk then. So my feeling is that when you're doing real strenuous exercise, so my feeling is that when you're really putting your body to extremes, and I don't know exactly what they use the cutoff for very strenuous exercise. But those people, I do have the feeling that, like, very long distance running, where you're really stressing the body to these outer extremes, is probably not good for the body. We're really not meant to do that. We're not designed for that. But for the average person, and that's, you know, me going to the gym or you doing CrossFit and all of that, I don't believe that that is too extreme. It really depends on how intense you're going to get it. If you're pushing your body to the limits of the limits, probably not good for you. But if you're doing, you know, strenuous exercise where you're getting a good workout in and you're toning your body, you're losing weight, you're more fit, you're eating healthier, likely much better for you rather than really pushing you to the extreme of extremes. And the same with a car. You can drive a car faster, but when you're going down the highway at 60 miles an hour in first gear, probably not so good for the engine.
Well, go ahead, Dr. Teeters. Go ahead, yes.
No, I was going to say, I think what Dr. Malin is alluding to is exactly right, and we always kind of allude to this marathon effect that, you know, in fact, we see even patients who do run marathons or do these extreme sport-type things, that they will actually show muscle breakdown. And mm-hmm. at the heart is a muscle. Mm-hmm. And so the same strain that you're putting on those leg muscles, you're putting on the heart itself. And so there is something to be said against these very high extreme, long exposure type exercises. And it also matters about, are you the weekend warrior who goes out and does these kind of things, or is this something that you're training your body to do? Obviously, you know, the body is a machine and it can be trained and can be sculpted to kind of do, you know, fairly exalting feats, but at the same time, no one should jump off the couch and go run 26 miles by any stretch of the imagination. And so that's why we see, especially with these things like these tough mudder races and the like, folks go without really training themselves and expose themselves to very extreme types of exertion and stress, and oftentimes that can be harmful to the heart.
You mentioned, like, runners, for example. The number of runners or those involved in marathons has increased more than 10 times in some cases since the 70s. So for those who love to compete and they love that high-intensity workout, what would you say to them? I mean, should they stop? Do they need to tone it down?
I don't think they necessarily need to stop. I think, you know, as we'd say with anything that you would eat, it's also got to be everything in moderation with exercise as well. And I tell my patients all the time that, you know, exercising doesn't mean you have to go out and run 16 miles. The average person needs about 30 minutes a day, 5 to 6 days a week, going at a pace where they can't sing or hum a tune, but they can still speak and complete sentences while they're exercising. So for most of us, that's not a terribly high pace. That's a moderate-paced walk to accomplish a cardiac exercise. But for those who are going to train and want to do these more aerobic feats, that's okay. But certainly I don't think that should be a daily activity that you go and push yourself to that kind of extreme.
What are the implications of this study then for other sports, like high-intensity sports, if we were to look at strenuous, with associated with strenuous activity, like hockey, for example?
From my standpoint, I think that those type of sports are just fine. The studies I think they were from Europe, but they're looking at these real high intensity things. So, and as Chad alluded to there, you know, these ultra marathons. These I don't know too much about the Tough Mudders, but you know, these extreme triathlons. I mean, those are meant for people who have really, really trained very hard to do this. You don't get up and do this, so it's you've somewhat conditioned your body. But for the everyday sports, the football, the hockey, you know, the 2-3 mile jog, going on the treadmill or the elliptical at the gym, that's not what was looked at here. And that is those type of things, I think, are just fine. They give you far more cardiovascular benefit than would be any harm. And I encourage all of my patients to do those type of things, because that's what gives you the real benefit. And additionally, as what Chad pointed out, is a brisk walk, 30 minutes a day, 5-6 times a week, is going to give you far more bang for the buck than not doing it. It will reduce your risk of cardiovascular disease, it will reduce your blood pressure, it will reduce your weight, and it will reduce your cholesterol.
We have the benefit of digging into this much deeper, but for some people that may be listening and others, they could hear about this and they just get a snapshot, so they're not aware of those things that weren't included and what the cutoff for extreme exercise was and certain questions like that. Are both of you, do you worry at all when people hear about the studies, these two new studies, that they may choose not to exercise?
I think, you know, these tabloid-type studies that come out do give people fuel for the fire to believe what they want to believe. And, you know, the resveratrol is a perfect example. A lot of people kind of got the wind knocked out of them when they heard that the red wine wasn't going to prevent their heart disease. And, you know, maybe they didn't need to take that hypertension medication. They could just drink more red wine and they'd be okay. And likewise, you know, people say, oh, see, here's a study that says I don't really need to exercise because it's bad for me. Mm-hmm. But these are extreme examples. And I think everything, and I think Tim would agree 100%, everything that we talk about is moderation. And I think anything that you do beyond that moderation is actually probably harmful. And any one thing trying to overdo, whether it's resveratrol or a supplement or exercise, probably not the right answer and may be worse than it is better.
I want to ask both of you, Dr. Teeters and Dr. Malins, one thing I hear from my doctor, I'm sure others that are listening hear from their doctors as well, is this word moderate, and you both used it. What does that mean when we hear that? And the best kind of exercise for us is moderate exercise. Can you both kind of break down what exactly that means and how we should follow that?
Sure. From my standpoint, I'll even actually talk about the moderate alcohol consumption. So what I tell female patients is, really, I wouldn't go much more than a glass, maybe a glass and a half of wine a day, and for men, not to exceed 2 glasses or equivalent amounts of beer or whiskey. When it comes to exercise, it depends where they are. And so moderate exercise for an 80-year-old is different than moderate exercise for a 20-year-old. And so for an 80-year-old, I would say just get out and walk. I mean, you've already proven, you've made it to 80, you've already proven that, you know, you've got good genes, you've probably taken pretty good care of yourself, and you want to have the time that we have left as being healthy. And so get out and walk, as Chad said, 30 minutes a day. For somebody who hasn't exercised, I would say do the same thing. For those who already exercise, what I would say is a moderate intensity workout, say they run or something like that. I would say for 30 to 45 minutes, if that's what they're doing, 3 times a week, ensuring that, you know, they've got good shoes and that they're taking care of their body as well. But it really, this moderate is really depend upon where you are in the spectrum. If you don't do anything, moderate is getting out for a brisk walk. If you're already doing a brisk walk and you want to increase it a little bit, then, you know, get on the treadmill and increase the incline, get on the elliptical machine. There's a lot of things, but the The fact of the matter is you want to get your heart rate up there. You want to do it several times a week. It's going to give you great amounts of benefit. I never recommend somebody to do, you know, do a triathlon or something like that unless they are in really tip-top shape and have really planned for it. Another really good moderate exercise is getting to the pool and swimming laps. Using almost all muscle groups, you're training your breathing, and those who have that available to them, I find, is a very good way to get your aerobic activity for cardiovascular protection.
And I think one way that I like to define moderate for my patients is people have a hard time using heart rate prediction or, you know, even as Tim alluded to, picking a certain type of exercise, because what may be exercise for me may be unconscionable for an 85-year-old patient to be able to do that. So I think using that respiratory rate and saying, if you can still sing or hum your favorite tune, then you're probably not pushing yourself hard enough and you need to increase the intensity. However, if you can't carry on a conversation with someone walking next to you without huffing and puffing and not being able to complete a sentence, then you're more into an aerobic work zone, which is great, but you don't need to be at that intensity necessarily to get the cardiac benefit. So go to a pace where you can't sing or hum a tune, but don't need to push yourself faster than the point where you can still carry on a conversation.
I'm sure that both of you have had patients who are quite stubborn. I know people in my own life who are stubborn when it comes to exercise. And this study, as Dr. Cheers, you kind of touched upon, would be an excuse to not get active and not get actively involved, rather. You broke down how to do it, how to do it in a moderate way so that it's not too much, it's not too strenuous. For those people who, they are stubborn and they're not going to want to get off the couch and they may use this as something to fall back on, what would you say as doctors to encourage them to do that, to do so, to get up and to move?
Yeah, I think one of the big things to say is severalfold. Number one, you know, people very easily will say, I don't have 30 minutes in my day. And I hear that quite a bit. And most of the data will say that you can do as little as 5 or 6 minute blocks of exercise at a time. And as long as it totals 30 minutes a day, you're getting the same benefits as if you did all that 30 minutes at one time. So how many of us can't say that we can take a 5 minute walk at lunch and before work or what have you, or when we go to Wegmans, instead of parking in the front of the parking lot, we can park in the back of the parking lot and walk our way in, or take the stairs instead of the escalator or elevator. So these kind of health changes that we incorporate into our life, even if we do have a day where we can't necessarily go out and run laps around the block, even those little changes that we make a big difference. And so that's why there's all this push from the American Heart Association to get a certain number of steps into your day so that you're actually getting up and moving. And any movement is better than sitting. And so, you know, it doesn't have to be on day one that you hit that 8,000 steps, but it's something to certainly strive to, and you should be doing it more often than not, and there really isn't much excuse not to do that.
Well, since I've got two doctors on the line, I'm going to take the opportunity to ask a personal question. So I told you I do my CrossFit boot camp, and it is high intensity. And there are days when I'm done, and I can't move my arms later in the day, and I'm absolutely exhausted, and probably by 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I want to take a nap, and my energy levels are extremely low. For an example like that, because I know there are many people who do that as well, and you push, and because you want that good workout, and you want to work out your heart, but then in the middle, end of the day, you're beat and you're exhausted. What would you say to people like me? Is it too much, and what would you say to me to maybe scale down a bit?
From my standpoint, I think CrossFit is probably just fine. I mean, you're obviously getting a very good workout, and it's not too uncommon, especially, I mean, I work out, and I feel the same way at times. I mean, what I would probably recommend to you, if you're doing that, to make sure that you're having enough calories in the day, that you're not, you know, really going low calorie and you're really using all of your calories. And the reason why you're tired is because you don't have energy to do anything. And so you've got to remember that in people in your situation, you've got to make sure that you have the energy to do it. And if you're going into calorie debt every day because you're getting these very, very intense workouts, that may be why you're so tired. And CrossFit is, I have not done it. I have friends who do it, and I've seen really fantastic results. And personally, I don't, my biggest concern with these extreme exercises is more of the long endurance type of races, these, you know, ultra marathons, these Ironman triathlons. I'm not saying you can't do it safely, But those are the big concern. But I think CrossFit is a great workout if you can do it. And as long as you're maintaining the energy intake, you're going to probably feel a little beat down and want to take a nap. But I think it's a good workout.
And I would ask, go ahead.
I was going to say, one other thing that people don't take into account, and that's probably the easiest thing, is that, and I do this myself, I go and do my exercise in the morning, and then I grab my cup of coffee, and off I am to work, and then
yes.
I see patients for 5 or 6 hours straight, and I've not realized that I haven't really hydrated at all.
Exactly.
And now I've burned all this fluid, and I've just taken in a diuretic in the coffee, and then I wonder why I feel bad, but I've actually imposed a state of dehydration on myself that makes me feel badly. So eating is important, making sure you get those kind of power foods, the fruits and vegetables and the almonds and that kind of thing. But also trying to strive to that 6 to 8 glasses of water a day, there's something to that. And needing to keep up that hydration is certainly important.
I've noticed I get my migraines every now and then if I'm not properly hydrated after I work out. So that's definitely a good tidbit for those who are listening and are involved in that semi-high intensity workout like that to do. So thank you much for that. And thanks for taking my personal question as well on the air. So I want to thank Dr. Tim Malins. He's a Rochester General Health System cardiologist, and also Dr. Chad Teeters, a cardiologist at Highland Hospital. Thank you for breaking down these two studies in terms of red wine and also high intensity workouts and the need to maybe incorporate a more moderate workout into our daily lives. So thank you for joining me today on Healthy Friday.
Thanks for having me.
Great night.